I have the privilege of announcing our speaker, Sybil.
We're going to let you talk right into it. They're saying they're not hearing too good.
I think my voice will probably carry. Hi, everybody. My name is Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Corwin, and I am an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. Matt and I got here. I think there were about five or six people here. We're early birds. I'm always comfortable when I can get to a meeting early instead of getting to a meeting late. Only once can I remember getting to a meeting when the steps were being read, and then after that they said, now we'll hear from Sybil, and I was a nervous wreck. You walk in, sit down, and they call on you, and you're not emotionally prepared to get up and talk. You know, this is a big group, and I have never been here before. Didn't actually know precisely where it was, except in a general way, but Matt drove me, thank God. My husband is in Imperial Valley. Bob, some of you may know him, and they're having a convention down there, their second roundup. And he called me just before I left to come here tonight to tell me how much fun he was having. And I said, I gotta go, Matt's gonna be here to pick me up, and you call me after the meeting. And he said, well, it might be midnight. And I said, well, that'll be all right, I want to hear all about it. And I'll have more to tell you about the Northridge group. So it's a real good thing to be married to another member of AA. Bob's favorite saying is, yes, it is good to be married to another member of AA unless both of you go crazy at the same time. And of course, with alcoholics, you don't know. I don't mean drink, I mean just pop off, you know. And Bob and I have pretty much the same personality. If he pops off, I pop off. But generally speaking, we have a lot of fun together. We've been married, 1967 to now. 17? That's a lot of years. With all those names I gave you, I had four others. Bob is the fifth, and I certainly am going to keep him. I met him in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the old covered wagon days of Alcoholics Anonymous, when he was trying out AA unsuccessfully because he was an atheist, a real one. His father raised him to be an atheist, and he came to AA very belligerent and willing to argue. And you know the answer to that. He drank. And he drank until 1963. And I was secretary of the central office. I started there in 1955 with Carol Alexander as my assistant. And I happened to go back to my old home group, the Hole in the Ground. And I stayed, and after the meeting, Duke Carson and I sat there talking about this one and that one and the other one, and it was quite late. Must have been 11:30. We were still sitting there in the old Hole in the Ground. And there was a terrible pounding at the door. And Duke said, who in the hell is that? And I said, I don't know. And he says, well, I'm going to find out. He said, the son of a gun's trying to break in. And he went and opened the door, and it was Bob Corwin, my husband to be. And Bob had come back. And that was in 1963. And he came to believe, but it took him a long time. And he found it in his own way, and he has good sobriety. He's a good member. And we enjoy going to AA together and separately. Quoting him, he always says this, that he's having a love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can say the same thing. And I think that's okay, because, in fact, I think it's a darn good thing to say that the longer you go, the better you like it. And that's the way it is for a lot of us. I think if new people could come to know soon that when they get here, it's going to really get most enjoyable after you get to feeling better and you make some friends and you find other people who tell your story almost, and they understand and have compassion and they're forgiving and they don't care what you did or where you've been. There's absolutely no distinction in whether you're a millionaire or a ditch digger. And I really don't know what a lot of my friends do for a living. I just never bother to ask. It doesn't seem to make any difference. And we go to a lot of meetings in the Pasadena area because we live near there. We live in Mount Washington, which is a fancy name for Highland Park. It's a hill, right? Really a hill, they call it a mountain. And we live at the bottom of it. Elsie Faye Maroney lives at the top of it. The more money you have, the higher you go up Mount Washington. You get on the bottom on Marmion Way, and that's where we poor folks live. We bought that house 9 years ago and accumulated a menagerie, which holds us back quite a bit when we want to go to a convention together, because we had 4 dogs and 4 cats. And you try feeding them or find a house sitter when you both want to go out of town, and it's pretty hard. And it's pretty expensive if you put them all in a kennel. And it isn't a good thing to do in that neighborhood or in any neighborhood these days, because you'd come back and your house would be ripped off and you wouldn't have a home anymore. But when Matt picked me up tonight, he can tell you that police dog really barked. Oh, Heidi, she takes good care of the property. And I'm at home now, a little bit not comfortable being there alone at night. Not afraid, but it seems strange to have Bob at a convention in Imperial Valley, and here I am at home with all little four-legged friends walking around there, all the cats and dogs and just me. And I sure was glad to see you tonight. I was getting a little bit spooky. I guess I was born spooky, a little weird and crazy, because I never did seem to fit in wherever I was. In school, I never felt popular, and I wasn't, I suppose, and I never felt at home. That began in Texas when I was a little girl. We moved out here when I was 13 to this big city of Los Angeles, and I started school there in the 8th grade, and I want to tell you, I was a miserable 13-year-old girl. I had unusually heavy hair, and it came down to my knees, and my father wouldn't let me cut it, and all the other girls had short hair. And here I would try to do something with this long hair and wind it around and put some of it up in the back. And we had moved from Burke Burnett here. We had lived in Waco prior to that. And Burke Burnett was an oil town at that time. If any of you saw Boomtown, that was about Burke Burnett, and that's where we lived. And it was a city of army tents, because it was simply a temporary affair, that oil boom. And to come out here and suddenly be thrown into a city school, I was miserable. And after graduating and taking a short-term business course in high school, I went to work. But my drinking began when I was 15 or 16, and I don't remember. My father was so bitterly opposed to alcohol, he would say things like, if a rattlesnake bit me on my left arm right here, and I'm listening carefully to Papa, if a rattlesnake bit me there, and a man would walk up to me and he'd say, Mr. Adams, I've got some whiskey here and I can just pour a drop of that on that snake wound and it will heal it right away. And Papa would say, no, sir, don't touch me with that whiskey, just get a dull knife and cut my arm off up to the shoulder. And I'd hear him say that, and I'd wonder, what is that terrible stuff, whiskey? And I just couldn't wait until I found out, really. I was telling Matt on the way out here that I'd jump out the window and go meet a boyfriend, and he had a motorcycle 3 or 4 blocks away from my house, and I would be over there after school riding around on his motorcycle, and then I'd go home and ask Papa if I could go somewhere. You're not leaving this house after dark. Well, I know, but I just want it. No, when you're 18, you can do as you please. But as long as you're a teenager in my home, you're not leaving this house after dark. And so I couldn't have a boyfriend walk home from school with me or anything. He says, now, after you get married, it's just your business what you do, but until then, you'll do as I say. So I got married. And that took care of that. And I started drinking right after that. In fact, I was amazed when I was married and I went to a party and they served booze, because I'd been hearing about that stuff all my life. And I just drank all I could hold and fell down, unconscious. So I don't know what it's like to be a social drinker. And that went on for 17 years against my better judgment. And I didn't want to do it. It was bad. And I just simply couldn't take any more doing the usual things that drunks do. I was a bar drinker. I didn't want to drink at home because of my baby, my little girl. And so I would drink at bars and get thrown out or kicked out. Or I remember crawling 2 blocks, Broadway to Figueroa. I had a real estate office at 7711 Figueroa. So you know how far it is from Broadway to Figueroa. It's equal of 3 or 4 short blocks. And I remember the bartender threw me out one night. I don't know what I'd said or done, but he was tired of me. And I would fall down and crawl a little bit and get up and run a little bit and fall down. And when I got up those steps of my house, my nylons were hanging behind me. They were all torn to bits. And I would wake up with this terrible hangover and want to die. I just didn't want to be a bad wife and mother at all, but that's what I was. And then I always got in my car and drove someplace that I had no business to be, didn't know anyone there. And I found myself in San Francisco one morning, and it was just getting daylight. And I remember leaving my home, going across the street for a short beer to go back to my real estate office and sell a house to somebody, pretty good prospect, and I never did show up. And I didn't know anybody in San Francisco. And I was not able to drive home, and I did the best I could till I got on the ridge route, and the ridge route was a mean road in those days, and I picked up a hitchhiker. And the next thing I know, because I got in the back seat and went to sleep, turned out he was a nice fella, just broke. He pulled up in front of Sixth and Hill and said, "Lady, we're in Los Angeles." And I gave him a $5 bill and parked my car there and thought, I can't go home because I don't know what to say. Dick will be so mad at me because I promised I'd never do this again. And he had said that he would divorce me and take the little girl if I ever showed up missing again. And fortunately for me, being as sick as I was and not wanting to think the whole thing out, the newsstand was right here. I picked up a magazine, the Saturday Evening Post. And I didn't look at the date. I just wanted to go in that Turkish bath right there. It said Sultan Turkish Baths. And I thought, that'll get me over the shakes, and I can stay all night there. I won't get bawled out. Nothing will be any worse if I stay out another day. I'll be in better shape to cook up another good lie when I get home, and maybe he'll still be there. Maybe I'll still have my little girl and can lie my way out of this one. And so I took that Saturday Evening Post, and I went downstairs and had the Turkish bath, and you know the little cubicles you sleep in. And I picked up the Saturday Evening Post, and it was dated March 1st, 1941. And on the cover it said, Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander. And it just hit me right between the eyes. Because I had read about AA in Liberty Magazine in 1939. Fulton Osler had written a little piece called Alcoholics and God. I was at my mother-in-law's home in San Diego, and I picked it up, and I was hurting, and I was suffering, and I was ashamed and remorseful, and I didn't like the way I was living. And they were lovely people, and I tried to keep it from them, but you know you never do. And I had picked up this Liberty magazine and read this little piece, which didn't amount to a whole page. It was a half page, if that. It said something like, there's a band of men in New York City who are meeting regularly for the mutual purpose of gaining and maintaining their sobriety, and they called themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was about the size of it. But it impressed me a lot. And I remember thinking at the time, imagine that, a bunch of men meeting in New York and staying sober, and they seemed to be like me. But I didn't take the magazine, I didn't do anything about it. Now here I am in that Turkish bath with that Saturday Evening Post, and when I see on that cover, Alcoholics Anonymous, 2 years later, I thought, I still have a chance. And I didn't know what they did. I didn't care. I thought they might just vaccinate you and send you home cured. That would have been fine. I didn't know what they did because I was too sick to really read the article. I just knew about AA because I had seen it in Liberty, and here it was again. And all I did was look at the pictures. And it showed a man being put on a stretcher. And they put him in an ambulance, and I thought, oh, he's sicker than I am. And I turned the page, and there was this man in a bed. And two men were sitting there with him in the hospital. Probably our founders, maybe, Bill and Dr. Bob, I don't know to this day. And I didn't read the rest of the article, but I turned to the end of it and got the box number. It said something like, if you have a drinking problem and you want help, write Alcoholics Anonymous at such and such a P.O. box in New York. And I did. I wrote a pitiful letter of some kind. I didn't save any of that stuff because, you know, you never know what's going to be important later on. If we saved everything that we ever had, we couldn't even live in the house. But this letter said something like, I read your article in the Saturday Evening Post. I'm a desperate woman alcoholic and I need help. That was about it. And I went on home and fixed it up with the family again. I don't know how. And I got an answer right away. And that answer came from a gal that not the newcomers won't mean a thing to them. But to me, it means everything. The letter in response to my request, was Bill Wilson's secretary. Our founder is Bill Wilson. He met Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob is our co-founder. And Ruth Hawk had worked for Bill and Hank Parkhurst for years before Bill had this idea about AA, see? They had a little automobile accessories shop, not making any money. And he and Hank came up with this idea because they went to the Oxford group meetings. And eventually, you know what happened. We got AA, and that's the way it started. And so here were these pictures, and I wrote this letter, and the answer came. And Ruth Hawk, who turns out to be my very best friend, and I'll call her my sponsor regardless of the fact that she's a non-alcoholic. She comes out to California quite a bit because her daughter, Lori, is a member in Orange County with 9 years sobriety. And I got to see her in person. I mean, that meant a lot to me, to get to see the lady that answered my letter for help. She said, you don't have to come back to New York to find Alcoholics Anonymous because AA started in California in December of 1939. Four men in the General Hospital was handed the big book, the big red first edition of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. They were in there for alcoholism. And they read that book when they were getting well, and when they got out of the hospital about the same time, they said, we better stick together. This seems like a good thing. One of the guys, whom I knew well, Clarence McFadden, said, well, we can meet at my house. And the other fellow from Pasadena said, well, then the next week you can meet at my house. And they did that for a while, and they grew very slowly, and they'd get up to five or six or eight. You know how that would go, about the average that any group would have. One would drop out, and they'd get two, and two would drop out. And they really didn't grow. They didn't. Alcoholics Anonymous was not known that well, and neither was alcoholism. I didn't know it was a disease. So consequently, when I got my letter, she said there was a meeting, why, I was just tickled to death. Now, whether I got drunk during that week or so before I got an answer, I don't know. Probably did. And she told me where they met, in the Elks Temple, across from Westlake Park, which is now MacArthur Park. And the Elks Temple is just right there, you know, great big building. And they met in a dining room off the big lobby. And my non-alcoholic husband drove me down there because he thought that if I didn't get fixed then, he was going to divorce me. So he was willing to drive me down there. And I went in there and I didn't even look up because all the AAs in California were sitting at a table like one of these, and it was full. So we'll say that there were 10 or 12 guys sitting there, because I was so miserable I didn't even look up. This long hair, I had it permanent, and permanents in those days were rotten. They were kinky, curly. It was a mess. I had this heavy hair all pushed up under a red turban, and my cheeks were bloated. My face was so bloated, my eyes were bloodshot. Matched the turban, really. And if the dresses were long, then mine were always short. I was always one style behind. If they were short, my dresses were long. And there I sat looking down. And then the man got up at the head of the table. They didn't have a mic system or a podium or anything. And he said, this is a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in California. We're a band of ex-drunks who've gathered together to obtain and maintain our sobriety on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. How would you like to have heard that at your first meeting? Scared me witless. I thought, what an order. I can't go through with that. I couldn't believe that. It was just too much. And I was still thinking about that statement, and he was saying something else, and I wasn't hearing it. I was hearing all-time basis. And then he said, but as is our custom, before the regular meeting starts, the women will have to wait out in the lobby. And I was the only one there. Now, wouldn't you imagine if it had been you that you would have thought that that was a polite way of saying you're not wanted here? Before our regular meeting starts, the women will have to leave. You can come back later for coffee and donuts. And I got up and put my hands over my face, so humiliated. You will never know how I felt when I went out that door and went back out in that big lobby. I was so crushed. And my non-alcoholic husband, who hadn't had a short beer in his life, sat there all dressed up, and they thought he was a new man, and they were just giving him all the good shots they could think of. He didn't tell them anything, so the meeting went on for hours, and I'm out there waiting. And he finally comes out, and I said, well, give me my pills and let's go home. I thought maybe it was medicine or something you took. And he said, Sib, you'll never know what I've been through. Oh, God, he said, you'll never know. All they did was brag about their drinking. One guy said he drank a fifth a day for 20 years. Another one said he drank two-fifths a day for 40 years. And he said all they did is just talk about how sick they were. And they read something out of a book. And he said, I can't figure it out. Let's go home. And I cried all the way home. And when I thought, I'll just have to die, I guess, you know. I can't get in on that. And I even had my letter from New York as my authorization. I kept that letter and was going to go down there and say, here you are, sir. Here's my letter from New York. This entitles me to be a member here. How much do I pay? Anything, you know. I was going to take my letter to get in, and I didn't even get to show it to him. But I did something in the bar, and the bartender threw me out, and it was nearly 2 o'clock anyway. And when I got out on the sidewalk, I remembered my letter. And I thought, I'm going to tell those people off. You just bet your life I'm going to sure tell them off right now. So I put a nickel in the pay telephone, and Cliff Walker answered. You'll read about him in AA Comes of Age, because Cliff Walker answered all the 12-step calls for California until we got a central office in 1944. And I said, remembering the Saturday Evening Post article and that ambulance, I had concluded that was an AA ambulance. And it was just as plain to me as anything could be that it would be a big, white, gleaming ambulance with two big red A's on the side of it, saying AA. So when I put the nickel on the telephone and Cliff answered, I said, send your AA ambulance and pick me up. And he said, well, you're drunk. I said, well, of course. You would be too if you'd been down there at that meeting tonight. They threw me out, and I had a letter of authorization from New York. And he said, no, they wouldn't have done that. You've made a mistake. No, I haven't. And he said, well, why do you say they threw you out? They said, well, they said the women had to leave. Oh, he said, listen, they've never had a woman alcoholic. That meant the wives. If any show up at that meeting, they always make that statement. They thought you were just a wife. There was no Al-Anon then, of course. And so they hadn't meant to insult me, and I just took it wrong, you see, and it almost killed me. It just about did. And he said, you go back down there next Friday, and in the meantime, I'll get hold of them, because I'm a milkman, and I have to deliver my milk right now. It's 2 o'clock, and I have to have it delivered by daylight. I can't come and get you, and besides, we don't go and pick up drunks at bars. Sober up. I can go down there next Friday, and I'll have it all fixed up, because I'll call Mort and Frank Randall and Mort Joseph, and tell them they're going to have a woman alcoholic. Well, I got so mad at him, I said, young man, I'll go home for one reason only. And that is so that I can phone New York in the morning and see that you're fired. I was very haughty. But I went back the following week. I didn't go alone because my big brother Tex Adams came over that week, and he read the pamphlet that Ruth had mailed me, and I had not even picked it up. It never occurred to me to pick up a pamphlet. It wasn't a skinny little pamphlet. It was a 7x8, not very many pages. And the only thing I remember in it is it said they had a new group in Houston. So that didn't help me any. It had the steps, but I didn't read that either. But my brother Tex had read it, and when he came over, he picked up that pamphlet and read it, and he said, I don't want it for me, Sib. He said, I won't even drink with you anymore. You're the worst woman drunk I've ever seen. But he said, I'm going down there and find out where the money's going. And I said, yeah, but you say you're not an alcoholic. And he said, well, I'm not. I bailed him out of jail 89 times. He said, I'm not. But he says, they won't know that. And so I'm going, and I'm going to take those winos that work for me in my vegetable produce business down on Skid Row, because I can't even get a full crew together. Those winos are in Lincoln Heights all the time. I'm okay. They're not. They don't show up. Sometimes I can't even pedal my route or get the trucks out to sell those vegetables. And he said, they need help, and I'm going to see if they got anything down there and who's pocketing all that dough. And I said, you better be sober, Tex. He says, I will. I won't cross you up. I'll not go down there with any booze on my breath. So he went with me. But what happened is he came over that next Friday night. There's only one meeting. I mean, you went to that one, or that was it. You had to wait a week. He came over in his vegetable truck, and standing up in the back were 11 winos. His whole crew, and we all go down to the mother group together. And the mother group hadn't had a chance to grow yet because the letters were just being received by Ruth Hawk, and you see, the impetus of the article hadn't hit. My letter got there early, I guess, or something. And so there were about a dozen, as I say, and I sat there with my head down, and when this guy made that statement, and then he said the women had to leave, it just about killed me. Well, Cliff Walker fixed up everything, and I went back down the following week, and I don't know why, really, because I was easily hurt. Who wouldn't be under those circumstances? And my brother Tex went with me. And they didn't like him, and he didn't like them, and he was such an extrovert that they threw him out. They really did. They went up to him, and they said, we hear you're trying to start another group, and you're not loyal to the mother group. You're not even dry behind the ears yet. And so anybody who'd come to this meeting and find out how we run it, then go start another group, the Hole in the Ground in Huntington Park, that's just disloyal, and so we've talked about it, and we want you to leave, and we're excommunicating you. And Tex said, well, the hell you say, I'd just like to see that happen, and he sat down. He said, I won't be here much, I won't have time. I'm just starting the Hole in the Ground, I'll be very busy, but any time I get ready to come back here, I'm going to come. And he did. So they didn't like him from the word go. And I was on shaky ground myself, I figured. I heard later, Cliff Walker told me that because I was his sister, that they even talked about throwing me out too. We didn't have any traditions, really. We had nothing to go on. And everybody was full of fear. They didn't want somebody to come along and louse it up, you see. But that night, I listened. And when Frank read out of the big book, I naturally didn't absorb the steps or anything, but I'll tell you what happened. He had 512 step calls that had come in during that week. That first week, you know, I was thrown out. Now I'm going to a meeting where I'm allowed to stay because Cliff had fixed it up. And he had a big carton box full of 12 step calls, all bundled up according to county or town. There were some from Santa Barbara, one from Fresno, and one from Hanford. I remember the guy's name, Jim Shea. He ran the depot there in that little town of Hanford. And then the local boys. And so he began handing, saying, this is his statement. He had a lot of personality and he got away with it. He said, hear this, you jokers. Any of you been sober over 15 minutes, come up here and get these 12-step calls. and make sure you go see these birds before next Friday, because it's a killer and it's a disease, and if you don't get them and bring them down here next Friday, some of them could die. And I really heard that, and I didn't know I was that bad off. I knew I was sick, but I didn't know that maybe I'd die. And so he'd call out San Bernardino, Riverside County, and Kent Hayden would go up and he'd get 50 or 60. And then he said, for Orange County, anybody here from Orange County? And Mel Trickey was a real estate broker, and he went up and got a huge bundle all tied up with white twine. And he went through the various areas, as I say, and it took a while. And I could watch that because it was very interesting. I was trying to make myself invisible. I didn't want anybody to see me, but I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what they were going to do with those letters, and I didn't know what a 12-step call was. And he went through the various areas, as I say, and it took a while. And I could watch that because it was very interesting. I was trying to make myself invisible. I didn't want anybody to see me, but I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what they were going to do with those letters, and I didn't know what a 12-step call was. And he got down to the last stack, and he said, now save this last stack here for a reason. I see we have a woman here tonight. I've been expecting her because Cliff Walker called me and said he had a phone call from a drunk woman named Sybil Maxwell. Are you Sybil Maxwell? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, come on up here, Sybil. Well, I couldn't. He said, come on up here, Sybil. All these letters are from women who want to get well and get sober, and I'm going to put you in charge of all the women. I heard that. And I remember thinking, as my knees wobbled and everything, when I went up there, I remember kind of thinking, getting up there seemed to take an eternity. I thought, Sybil's in charge. He's putting me in charge. I couldn't believe it. Sybil's in charge. And I thought, boy, you get promoted in a hurry here. I was thrown out last week, and now I'm in charge. So he said, now all these letters are from very sick women, and they want help. And you have to go see them and bring them down here next Friday. And I said, but what'll I say? He said, very little. You don't know anything. And that's the way it was. That's really the way it was. I'd ring a doorbell and do just exactly what he said. He said, have her letter in the envelope in your hand, and when you ring the doorbell, when she comes to the door, say, did you write this letter and ask for help with a drinking problem? And, well, yes. She'd see her own handwriting. So, well, I wrote a letter like that, and mine got answered last week. So I went down there, and I saw them. Not too many of them, but they were all men, and they were laughing and joking, and they read something out of a book, and there's some kind of a program they're following. But part of it is they made me come and see you, so they'll probably tell us how they're doing it. And so if you want to get sober as badly as I do, you come with me, and we'll just find out together. Now, he says, that's it. That's a 12-step call. And he says, don't say anything else because you don't know a thing. Not a thing. And that's what I did. I didn't say anything else. Just come with me. And they did. But I'm sorry to report that not too many of the women stayed sober. Alcoholics Anonymous was not well known. It was not fashionable, in quotes. I'm just saying that not to be cute, but I mean, it isn't too difficult to get here these days because we've had good press and we're well known and there's crowds of us wherever we go, and it's not quite as hard as it was then. But many of the husbands objected to their wives going down there. Most of them were married women, and husbands didn't like that too much. So after 2 weeks or 2 months or whatever, and it happened to me, but not for a while. I had been sober a very long time, and Dick was getting very fed up. He was lonely. He was a non-alcoholic. He would not go to the meetings. He refused. He'd go to a Christmas celebration or a picnic or whatever, but he wouldn't go to the meetings. He'd say, why should I go? I'm not an alcoholic. And I would come home, and he'd be sitting there with his chin jutted out, and he'd say to me, again? And I'd run over, and I'd put my head in his lap, and I'd say, I did promise you I wouldn't go tonight, but I had to go. A girl called me up, and I told her I'd meet her at the hole in the ground, and so on, you know. And he'd say, yeah, but again, and you promised. And the next week, it'd be the same way. And finally, it became unbearable. I came home from a meeting one night, and he had a smile on his face. And this was in 1948. And he said, come on in, honey, I've got the solution to our marriage. And I said, oh, I'm so glad. And I said, turn on the light in the living room, and let's go in there, and I want to hear. So tell me. He said, well, when we get settled. He says, well, I thought about it. And this is a solution. Now, you go back to drinking like you did in the good old days, and I'll take care of you. It'll be better than this. And I froze there, absolutely speechless. I remember getting goose pimples, and I thought I was going to faint, and I just stood there, I never said a word. I didn't say yes, no, or anything. I finally turned around, and I went upstairs and packed a suitcase. And I went out in the driveway where the new car was, and he was a wealthy man, and their house was just beautiful and everything. My little baby daughter from a previous marriage had grown up and got married at 16, so it was just the two of us and the housekeeper. And I went down there and looked at that car, and I wanted to get in and leave, and I thought, nope, I won't take anything. I didn't have all this when I married him. And I just caught a streetcar and went down to Adams and Figueroa, and I got a room. And the next morning, I got a newspaper, and I looked for a job, and I got a job on the Times newspaper. And I never looked back. And it hurt. I went out to the hole in the ground on the streetcar every night. One of the members would drive me back to my room. It was the St. James Park, down at Adams, and it was west of Figueroa a block. And there's a big church there on the corner, and I'd wake up in the morning and I could hear those church bells tolling, and I would cry. But I'd get up and get dressed and I'd go down to my job. He was a wonderful man. He was a good man, but he got tired of being lonely, and there was no Al-Anon and no program, and he didn't understand. And that was a lonely time of my life. I had thought that coming to Alcoholics Anonymous that everything would be just beautiful. That glow and that tremendous pleasure that I had at those meetings and being in charge of all those women for a while until a girl came along and threw me out. She wouldn't do anything I told her. And she walked in one time. She wasn't supposed to make any 12-step calls unless I handed them out to her personally. If you got a call, you gave it to Sybil. If you got a call, you gave it to Sybil. It was cleared through me. But one night I went to the mother group and Kay Riley walked in with five women and they were strangers and none of them had been cleared through me. And I just walked right up to her and I said, "Where'd you get those women, Kay?" And she said, "It's none of your business." I used to play bridge with them and cards when I was sober, but we all drank together and they watched me get sober and they finally asked how I was doing it and I told them and they said, "Can we go too?" And she said, "It's as simple as that, and I'm never going to report to you again, Sybil." And so I had come in with a very bad nervous twitch in my lip. It would go like this all the time. I'd go to meetings and my lip would do that for about 3 or 4 months. And my nervous twitch came back, and I was just inconsolable to think that she wouldn't do what I told her. And I hustled back out to the hole in the ground and told Tex. And he said, "Honey, those women are getting fed up with you. You better just tell them you're so busy helping your brother with a hole in the ground that you don't have time to be in charge anymore, or they're going to throw you out." And I did that, and it was painful. And I found out that in Alcoholics Anonymous that even though it's a happy program and that I enjoyed it and I loved the picnics and the dances and the meetings, I wouldn't participate. I couldn't talk. And I would sit in the back, and it was a participation meeting at the hole in the ground. And Tex got tired of that. And finally at my home one day, he had moved into my home. He developed a very bad heart and lived there until his death in 1952. He said, "Sib, you're going to stay sober. Remember, honey, I used to rock you to sleep. I'm 10 years older than you are, and I watched you, and you were a stubborn little girl, and you were a stubborn woman drinker. And I know you. You'll never drink again, but you're going to be miserable. Because when I call on people at the hole in the ground to get up and talk 3 to 5 minutes, they get up there. But," he said, "you won't. You hide in the back. And for the next 50 years, you'll be sitting in the back, miserable and afraid and scared to get up and talk. So I'm warning you in advance. Next Friday, I'm going to make it easy on you. You sit up in front, and the first person I call on will be you. And you won't have to be sitting there thinking about it all during the meeting, but you're going to get up on your feet and say something. And I don't care what you say, but you're going to get up." You know, that nearly killed me. All week long, I wrote out beautiful speeches on paper. And I would copy little things out of the book. And I worried about it. I was just sick with fright when I got there that night and sat out. And then Tex got up and said, "This is a regular meeting of the hole in the ground in Huntington Park, and the first person we're going to hear from tonight is my sister, Sib. Sib, get on up here and talk." And I got up there, and this group knew me really well. It was a very close-knit group, and this was a first. They knew how I felt. They understood me better than I understood myself. And I got up there, and I got my nervous tick back, and the tears came in my eyes, and I talked for a minute, 4 minutes, I don't know what I said. But all I know is what happened after. When I sat down, they began to applaud. And boy, those rafters just shook. They really applauded a long time. And I remember folding my arms and smiling to myself, and I thought, "My God, was I really that good?" And it got easier as time went by, but it was very difficult, very difficult. And then I went to work in the central office, and they said, "You have to go out before the groups that send in their contributions. If they ask you to speak, you just got to do that. I mean, it's... hate to put it this way, but it'll be good for the office for them to get to see the face of the person who answers the phone down there." So Carol and I would go off in different directions and we would talk. And I love participation meetings, and I love speaker meetings, and I love conventions, and I love everything about it. Somebody asked me tonight, do I get very nervous when I get up and talk? Not nervous or scared particularly, but there is wet palms and wishing I was dead and all those things. And then I'll tell you what makes life so wonderful, though, and makes talking a pleasure, because you're all my friends, so I don't even know all of you as well as I know Paul sitting back there. It's that we understand each other so well. You know me probably better than my own surviving brother, Clyde, who lives in Dallas. I go through Dallas maybe a couple of times a year, and I travel quite a bit, and I'll stop over and see him for a couple of days. Clyde was 5 years younger than my brother, Tex, a very straightforward businessman, fine family, no boozing, college graduates, all his kids, everybody doing fine ever since the day he was born. And I'll stop off in Dallas, and I love him dearly. And he'll say, are you still going to that AAA? And I'll say, yes, that's good. And then his wife will say, I think you just started going to that thing because your brother Tex went, and whatever Tex did, you wanted to do. You liked to drink with him, so you probably just started. You probably never were alcoholic in the first place. And I'll just change the subject and let it go at that and have a pleasant visit and come on back home. You can't make people understand. And they're not opposed to it. They just don't know. But things happen in Alcoholics Anonymous to alcoholics. Not all good things either. Because when my brother Tex died, somehow or other, I didn't react the way you would have. He had been sick so long, and I'd gotten so used to the idea. I had him in the hospital 17 times the last year of his life. And he'd get out of the hospital, and he would come back down to the hole in the ground. And he finally moved his hospital bed in the hall, over in that corner, and went out in that kitchen and cooked big pots of mulligan stew for the guys that would get out of Lincoln Heights. And they all heard, you know how it would be if you were in jail, go out and see Tex Adams. You can get a free meal. You probably have to stay for the meeting, but he'll feed you. And he'll give you a sack of Bull Durham. And he would, too. And so his heart was very bad. And I lived three blocks from that hall, which was open all the time. I was always full of guys getting sober or getting a free meal, didn't matter which. Most of them came back and stayed sober. And he'd be tender with some if they needed tenderness, and he'd be tough with some if they needed a little jogging, and he had a way of his own. And somebody came running up to my house and said, your brother just was feeding a drunk out in the kitchen, and he just went to sleep. And I said, is that right? And I didn't cry. And I went down the hole in the ground that right then in time before everything was over, really. And they began shutting the door and locking it. And I said, what are you guys doing? And they said, we're locking up the hall for a week out of respect to your brother. I said, you're not going to do any such thing. Tex would just have a fit. If you haven't got the guts to lead this meeting tonight, I'll do it. And I shouldn't have done that. So I did. And I didn't cry. And I called on everybody, you know how it is in a participation meeting, and I went on home, and I didn't cry, and I went back every night, and they'd say, how are you, Sib? I'd say, oh, I'm fine, how are you? But I wasn't. But I didn't know that. It was a coldness. I was just like I was made of stone. Now, whether or not that somewhere the cunning little alcoholic minds told me, don't let them know that you're suffering, because if you put on a good face, they won't hurt as much. They'll probably follow your example and not suffer. I don't know whether I was thinking kind thoughts like that or whether I was just sicker in the head than most people. And after a while, I couldn't put up with that. Smiling and showing my teeth and leading meetings and going to the meetings and saying, yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, everything's fine. And so finally, I knew I couldn't stand this anymore. I hurt physically, really, just ached all over with this hurt. So I wrote a letter, and guess who I wrote it to? Bill Wilson, the founder, no less. I couldn't talk to you about it or the people at the Hole in the Ground, but I wrote a letter to Bill. Tex had been up there and visited with him for a week in Bedford Hills, and Bill had been out here many times in the early days to kind of see how the program was working out here, and he would speak to us at the Shrine Auditorium. He came out with Dr. Bob, and they both talked there. And then the Hollywood Legion Hall, where they had wrestling or boxing, he came out and talked there. And he talked at the Pasadena group on Fremont. And I had been back in New York and I had visited with him. So now then I can talk to the founder about how I'm hurting. And I wrote him a pitiful letter. I don't know what I said. But I got an answer right away. And it saved my life because it started off, he said, I've read your letter about your brother Tex. And it was the most stirring thing that I have heard in many years. I knew your brother well. And this is what I believe, that in God's house there are many mansions. And somehow or other, I see your brother Tex out on the porch of one of those mansions, sitting in the sunlight, talking to another drunk. And he said, I like that. He said, I hope I do half as well when my time comes. But he said, now let's talk about you, my dear. As for you, my dear, I'll tell you this, that life is but a long day in school. Some of our lessons are going to be hard, and some of our lessons are going to be easy. And it's not so much what happens to us here, but it's what we do with the experiences we share. It's the demonstration that counts. And I read that over and over again, and that part about that life itself is just a long day in school, and some of our lessons are going to be hard, and some are easy. I cried buckets full of tears then, and have whenever I'm supposed to since then, and it's been easy for me to do that. Because that is the truth. We are in school. And don't let anybody ever tell you that old-timers are different, or that there's anything such as seniority in AA. One of my best friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, faithful to Alcoholics Anonymous, left AA for a while and got drunk after 28 years. It could happen to me. I don't want to leave. Don't misunderstand me. Nobody could force me to go to AA, but I love it so much. And you do too. And I don't want to go away. But I could revert back to being the same Sybil I was. And when I'm away from a meeting because I'm sick or for some other good reason for as long as 2 weeks, I begin to get nervous. I begin to worry about money. I count that money in my purse to see how much I have. And I'll say, that's good. I have 20 and there's a 10 and there's a 5. Look at all that change. And I get insecure. And it takes the form of worrying about money and being irritable with Bob over nothing. He'll say the dog wet the floor, and I'll say, well, clean it up, but you live here, don't you? Or some nasty remark. Just a plain old cranky woman is what I am. Now, this coming March, I will have 43 years of sobriety. And I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I always will be. And I haven't always, always been able to do it a day at a time. Sometimes I have had to take it a heartbeat at a time because I'm a human being. And I'm 75 years old. I'll be 76 in May. See, my 43rd birthday will be in March, next month, right? Then in May, I'll be 76 years old. So when I went back to that meeting the following week after I thought I'd been thrown out, and he made this statement that we're a band of alcoholics who are gathered together to stay sober, and if there are any women present, this was the remark that let me in, if there are any women present looking straight at me like that, that choose to call themselves alcoholic, they may remain. I folded my arms and I just remained from that day to this. So at 43 years or 43 months or 43 hours or whatever you want to call it, we're all the same, and I don't want to be any different or be treated any different or anything else, because I'd get my feelings hurt and I'd begin to stay home. And if I didn't get drunk, I'd go crazy and I'd die, because I'm Sybil. That's my name. And I'm an alcoholic. And through all of you, and I know that many of you know me and a lot of you don't, but I like the feeling in this particular group. I really and honestly do. There's a lot of friendliness here, and I can just tell that you love your particular meeting, and that's the way it ought to be. And I found that even conventions, I love conventions. Many people don't. But I can go to a convention, and there's always a hospitality suite. You don't have to, you know, necessarily hear the steps read at every turn. And I went to the San Fernando Valley one here just recently and loved it. Because the more AAs that I could see or bump into that maybe I wouldn't see otherwise during the year, it counts. And I know Bob is having a good time down there tonight, probably doing the same thing that I'm doing right now. But the thing that I like to think of is that we're, none of us old-timers, we're all fledglings learning to fly. That's what it amounts to, like little birds learning to fly. At first, we just had the book. And then when we were ready for it, we had the traditions. And nobody would read them. I was working in the central office, and we'd have stacks. They were gray then. We'd have 500 tradition pamphlets. And I remember groups saying, we don't need all that reading. After all, we got the steps. What do we need those traditions for? And it was hard for us to accept them. And then gradually I would go around to different meetings and I would hear them read, maybe. And it took years before it was part of our particular format. And in different parts of the country, there are good AAs and good groups and good towns that don't read them at all. I mean, AA here in California is not necessarily the way that it is in small towns or hamlets or large cities in other states. In some states, they don't even read the fifth chapter, but they stay sober. They talk about it, and they visit, and they make 12-step calls, but in a lot of places, they certainly don't read the traditions or the fifth chapter. And it's a remarkable thing to watch this thing grow in spite of us. And that we don't need to drink whether we lose our job or whether we're broke or whether we have a lot of money or whether we're a millionaire or whatever our circumstances may be, nobody cares. It's just that I know that if I have your phone number, that I can call you if I need help. And I made a big mistake in the beginning. I wouldn't let anybody know when I hurt. I couldn't. I was afraid they wouldn't love me anymore. So I just hurt and hurt bad. Because I couldn't confide and really be honest with another AA member because I wanted them to think I was perfect. And I wasn't perfect then, and I'm not perfect now. I'm a rotten housekeeper, and I never am going to change. I know that now. I accept the fact that I can't go to an AA meeting as often as I want and keep my house clean and the floors waxed and polished and have four dogs running around and hair in the corners, little white snowdrifts of hair. And we like it that way, obviously, or we wouldn't have those cats, too. And so it's just a losing battle. Now, you ladies will not agree with me. You're all orderly, and your homes are clean, and everything is waxed and polished. Whether you're Al-Anon or AA, I know that if you come to my house, I only request this, and I'm sincere about it, give me 2 hours' notice. Because, an hour will do, I'll take a hefty bag, and I will go around and I will gather up little odd things that hatch. I don't know where they come from. And I gather up these odd little things because about once a week I have a fit cleaning house. And you better be careful because I just cleaned it, Bob. Now, don't you put that dirty cup there. And I'll be very particular for about a week and then it goes downhill, depending on how tired I get. And it's rotten. Now here he is in Imperial Valley, and I was going to do all this wonderful stuff, and when he came home, he's going to say, why, honey, look at this house. Oh, it's wonderful, honey. And I thought, today, Saturday, he won't be home till Sunday night. I can get it done Sunday afternoon after the meeting. You know, and that's just the way it is, folks. I do what I can. But I never was very handy at housework, and I only do what I can possibly do, wash the dishes, cook the meals, feed the dogs, make the beds, and then sit there and worry about the fact that the rest of the women are probably baking cakes and doing all those nice, sparkly little things like hanging curtains. I wouldn't know how to hang a curtain. If anything happened to Bob, my windows would never have any curtains. It's too late for me to know how to thread a needle. I've got cataracts I'm supposed to have my eyes operated on, but I don't have time. See, I can just make excuses for anything about that housework. I just don't have time because I want to go to an AA meeting, and I know I'm a little bit crazy. But I'm weird. But so are you. Some of you, anyway, I hope. I hope there's some of you that's like me that will put it off and put it off and put it off. Procrastination isn't really nice. But it's only in some areas that I'm like that. But I love my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love all you people. I hope you'll ask me back here in a year or two, and I promise not to talk quite as long, and I'll just sit down, or I'll just come over here and visit anyway, because I love you all so much. Thank you for listening.
I think that was a very inspiring talk. Let's give Sybil one more hand. Huh? Yeah. I want to thank Rich for letting me lead the meeting. I want to thank my readers. And why don't I have my friend John read a vision for you and for anyone that would like. He can lead us in the Lord's Prayer.
Hi, I'm Max Friend John. I'm an alcoholic. A vision for you.
In the back.
In the back? I was secretary here for 7 months, I should know, but, you know, the mind still isn't. A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
February the 11th, 1984, at the Valley Club.